No one knew what had happened to me in Mexico. And Chris messages me in the middle of the night one night. And he's just like, why don't we try telling the story from your point of view in Mexico? And I was like, well, would you let me write a script? And then I remember reading it to Rebecca, Chris, and Isaac on the phone. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then my character like relapses, you know, and then there's this battle between me trying to get sober, but also battling with the fact that I relapsed. And like we get to the end of the call and no one speaks. And then Rebecca's like, wait, you just brushed over this bit. Wait, you relapsed?
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is The Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Gus Morton today. Someone I admire for both the impact they've had on cycling and the work they do in the sport and industry, but also for the example they set in regards to being a leader and having the self-confidence to promote dialogue about really challenging subjects. When Gus publicly announced his struggles with alcoholism last year, I think it caught a lot of people by surprise. But the way in which he decided to go public with his struggles with alcohol and the conversations he wanted to foster around it were really impressive and definitely caught my attention. When I was riding with Chris Burkhard, a mutual friend in Iceland earlier this year, and he started describing for me a film idea that was coming together that involved his January crossing, winter crossing of Iceland, alongside Gus and Rebecca Rush earlier that year, and combining that adventure story with Gus's struggle with alcoholism and the way the two intertwine, I was completely blown away. And so recently, when it was announced that Gus and Chris had launched a Kickstarter to try and get this film project across the finish line, I knew immediately that I wanted to support that, A, with my own contribution, and then also support it through awareness. And so the combination of my longstanding interest in getting to know Gus better and have him tell his story on the podcast, plus in light of this Kickstarter campaign, it seemed like now was the perfect time to have him on. You can find the link to that Kickstarter in the show notes or the description, whether you're listening on Spotify or iTunes or whatever, you should be able to click a link, have it take you directly to that fundraising page. Because I predict after you listen to this conversation, many of y'all will also want to get involved. I want to say a big thank you to Gus for giving me so much time. We recorded for quite a while and he brought the same openness and honesty to this long form conversation that he has in just about everything he's done recently. So it was an absolute pleasure and a privilege. I'd like to say a big thank you to Hammerhead for supporting today's episode. If you want to get more out of your rides, sure, most cycling computers can give you distance, time, and pace, but how about advanced GPS navigation and the ability to see upcoming hills and anticipated efforts required? The Hammerhead Karoo 2 helps you find your path forward and unlock your full potential. The Hammerhead Karoo 2 has raised the bar for cycling computers. You can get advanced GPS navigation and intuitive software right on your handlebars in a way you never thought possible. I rely on the Karoo 2 for anything and everything these days. Obviously, recently, for Unbound, the Unbound 200, my return to racing, I relied on it like crazy during my own crossing of Iceland last fall. The battery life on this thing is pretty mind-boggling in light of how much it does. You know, the more features something has and the more beautiful the display is, both of which the Karoo 2 is, the more energy that requires. But I've learned that when you throw this thing on battery save mode, it can go a really long time. So I ran it on battery save mode for Unbound, and 9.5 laters, I still had 51% battery. Pretty crazy. For a limited time, you listeners can get a free custom color kit and an exclusive premium water bottle with the purchase of a Hammerhead Career 2. All you have to do is visit hammerhead.io right now and use promo code STASH, that's all caps, STACHE, at checkout to get yours today. That's a free custom color kit and premium water bottle with the purchase of a Career 2. Go to hammerhead.io, add all three items to your cart, and use promo code STASH, all caps, STACHE. Thank you all so much for listening, and I'll catch you at the end of the show.
Sweet. So we've only really, I mean, we chatted ultra briefly at Sea Otter, but it was mostly a hey, hello thing. And we did a podcast. When did y'all do your
ice? It was over a year ago.
Yeah.
It was way over a year ago, actually. We did, it was like the end of, or the beginning of April, yeah. 2021.
Yeah, yeah. But it was three of y'all. It was you, Rebecca, and Chris. And as soon as we finished that conversation, I mean, I've done podcasts with Reba, I've done podcasts with Chris, but I knew immediately that I wanted to talk to you more, whether it be podcast or just having the opportunity to just chat at some point. And so I'm glad we're getting to do that. When we chatted during that podcast, it was I don't want to say it was a very enjoyable podcast, but it was maybe a bit more. It was like on the predictable side. Like we talked about the stuff that people would expect we would talk about. We talked about the adventure. We talked about all of the things that people probably would want to hear about. But we didn't spend much time talking about some of the deeper stuff that I didn't really know was going on. And actually, timeline wise, you hadn't gone to Mexico City yet, had you?
No.
Okay.
This story hadn't actually like
that's
happened.
That's crazy.
Yet.
Okay.
Right. So yeah. Like you're in the middle of it, and there was actually, to jump ahead, I wrote a scene when I wrote this. We had a screenwriter write as well, but when I wrote the first version of it, there was a scene that you were in. You were a character in it.
That's funny.
Like you weren't you. Yeah. But there was like
the interview scene
as like an expositional device. I was trying, it was clunky, but I was trying to like essentially like transfer all of the details of the trip to the audience without having to do like text on screen or whatever.
Totally.
Because I thought that they would want to know that. Anyway, so there was, yeah. Anyway, so just so you know that, there was that scene.
That's funny. So for anyone who maybe didn't hear that first podcast, if we can kind of put together just a rough timeline so that we can explore everything that's going on right now. And just kind of as a jumping off point for those that don't know, Chris Burkhardt and Rebecca Rush did the first ever winter crossing of Iceland. And there is going to be a film about it. When we did the podcast, the film was going to be very different than is what's cooking now. But can you just give us kind of a rough timeline of what happened? And then, you know, this travel to Mexico City. And then I have sort of funny anecdote that I want to add in, but if you want to just give us a rough timeline to set the stage.
Yeah. So, last year, 2021, in March, April, we, like Rebecca, Chris, and I crossed Iceland by bike. It took us, I think, a week with a couple of like days in there, downtime. And then after that, after we finished that, I had expected, I'm Australian, but I live in the US, and it was during COVID, obviously, so there was lots of different travel restrictions, and I had sort of expected the situation with traveling to change. Kind of a long story, but the government like announces every 3 months when they would either change the travel restrictions or they would like maintain them for another 3 months. And anyway, so like at the end of the trip, I had expected during that period for the travel restrictions to ease, and they didn't. And so like I found that out after we finished the trip, and I was like flying back to the US, going through Mexico. And so I ended up getting stuck in Mexico City, but kind of like because the rest of the crew were American, so they were able to fly home. And so I had to, like, after we'd done the trip, it was like a scramble after I realized that I might not be able to get back in, to like try and figure out a way, essentially. And that was to go through Mexico. And so it was like I just sort of left the others, and almost right after that, we recorded that podcast with you, which was like a day or two after we finished, mm-hmm. To try and get home. And then I ended up getting stuck in Mexico for 2 weeks.
Yep. What's funny is when we recorded that podcast, y'all recorded your own track, kind of like we're doing right now, because it mm-hmm. just makes for way better audio quality, obviously. And you'd sort of said, you know, yeah, I'll throw this in a Dropbox and shoot it over to you, you know, once I'm in Mexico City, because I'm literally like taking off tomorrow or whatever it was. And yeah. A few days later, I sent you a message and you said something sort of cryptically along the lines of, yeah, sorry, it's gotten hectic here, and like, I'll get it to you as soon as I can. And I think I asked one more time, but then I just started, you can kind of, even through a sentence or two message, sometimes you can kind of feel out the vibe. And I was like, you know what? Not going to push him on this. The podcast is great regardless.
Did I never get it to you?
But obviously. Dude, no, but I mean, the point is,
I mean, that makes
the
sense.
Point
yeah.
is, the point is, little did I assume that virtually anyone know, especially, I mean, not the least of which is me, that you were in Mexico City in a hotel room, just in a total war, which yeah. we can get into, not a literal war, but a personal war. And in hindsight, the fact that I was prodding you for this audio track is just so ironic to me, based on everything that, yeah. that came to light.
I honestly fully forgot that. I completely forgot that you ever messaged me.
But what's weird is I could feel something a little bit. And obviously I had no yeah. idea, but I knew that like it wasn't worth pushing the matter.
Something's like,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. That's funny that that was communicated.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, point being, let's maybe dive into that next phase. You had this adventure of a lifetime with two incredibly legendary athletes.
Yeah.
I assume learned an enormous amount. I frankly cannot wrap my head around what y'all did still. And based on conversations I've had with Berkey, he's like, yeah, that was up there for probably one of the most fucked up things that I've ever been a part of.
And that's funny hearing him say that, because he like seeks out the worst. I feel like he just seeks out the worst possible like experiences, like, or the most Absolutely. Physically demanding. It just like, he loves that. Yeah. So it's funny to hear him say that. And he's not wrong. I mean, it's for sure like one of the most psycho things I've ever done.
Yeah.
But also like, it was amazing. The best.
Yep. Yeah, so you went from this, you know, pinnacle experience to being stuck in a faraway land, just
yeah.
waiting, and sort of the opposite. Rather than having purpose, you're just like waiting for the passage of time.
Yeah, and I think like, exactly, and it's sort of funny, like talking about how this played out now, because I'm sure a lot of people are like, but didn't you know that the travel restrictions were going to be there, like be in place, like, you know, you're an idiot. And, you know, like, what are you complaining about? And sure, I did, like, I had an idea before I went, and I had even done prior to that trip, I had my 2 weeks in Mexico for another trip I'd done during the pandemic, like, 6 months earlier. So I was aware of it and had experienced it, but essentially, like, you know, you go and do the trip, and I went really deep, obviously. And coming out of it, anyone who's sort of done like those multi-day sort of expeditions, or even like multi-day kind of like hiking or riding or whatever trips, like, you kind of have this very, you're in a very strange headspace. Like, you're riding high, you know, for 24, 48 hours, and then you kind of like, you start coming down off of it, and you sort of, I don't know, you kind of, it's just a different, you're just in a very weird place. And I was sort of like so focused on the expedition, and I had been in touch with my lawyer, and they were expecting, like I said, an announcement to occur whilst we were out on the expedition. And I got back.
Sorry, what do you mean lawyer?
my visa, my like immigration lawyer. So I like I have like an immigration lawyer that that, you know, sort of like can give an assessment.
Totally.
What they sort of think. So I was sort of in touch with her and she's like, look, you know, they have an announcement at the end of March, and that will determine, you know, will determine if they open up the borders or not. And if they do, it'll be immediate. You know, it's like overnight. So I was like, okay, great. She's like, you know, at that time, COVID was, the COVID numbers were really low. And so it was sort of encouraging. And I just took that as like, okay, it'll be fine. And you kind of, I mean, you know, when you're sort of in denial, I guess, or like you're a little bit desperate. And so you just like assume things to be that way. And that's kind of how I came out of the trip. I was like, I didn't really want to think about what it would mean to have to go and do another quarantine period in like outside of home. So I just assumed that I could go home. And I just wanted to be home. And so when I found out that it wasn't the case, it was like such a scramble to like, I was like, okay, I think I can sort of circumvent this by going through Mexico. And, you know, like I'd heard people of doing that before, whatever else. And I just wanted to get home. And you know, you're also like, I've been tested for COVID like 8 times or whatever and tested negative. And I've been literally on a glacier. You know, like I definitely do not have it because I haven't been around anybody for 2 weeks. And anyway, so like I sort of was like, you know, felt fine in that regard. I just thought it was a frustrating rule. And so, yeah, so basically like scrambled really quickly to change the flights once we found out that that I couldn't just fly directly to the States. And then went to Mexico City. Like landed in Mexico City, spent the night there, had a flight the next day, went to the desk, and checked into the flight. And it was also a funny time because I was half vaccinated. You know, it was like just when the vaccines were just rolling out and like it had opened up to people of my age. And so I'd only gotten the first dose. So I also had this weird half vaccine and I just remember, you know, I've had anyone who's like been an immigrant in the US will have experienced this, but there's always that dreaded moment when you're either at like an immigration desk or at flight check-in and the person, you know, is asking you questions and you clearly say something wrong and they go, I just have to make a quick phone call. And you're like, oh God, this is not going to go well. And I just,
classic.
I remember that moment and I honestly hadn't thought about me not being able to get back in until that point, which is crazy to think about now. But like, that's what you do. I don't know. That's just how you work. Like when you, I don't know. That's how I was working. That's what I was, that was like the frequency that I was on at the time. And I just had this like such a strong desperation to get home anyway. Mm-hmm. And so like when he kind of came back and, you know, I distinctly hear him saying on the phone, like, well, he's half vaccinated. Like, does that count for anything? It's like, interesting. I mean, this, I was like, at least he's going into bat for me, this guy. And in the end, he said, sorry, you can't fly back. And I was like, are you kidding me? And you know, I don't know what, I just had your brain just blocks and I, and I didn't really like, I was upset. And he's like, oh, if you want, I can give you the phone number to the US consulate. Because he could see that I had a bandage on my finger because I'd gotten like a little bit of frostbite on my finger. Mm. And he's like, maybe you can get like a medical exemption or something to like fast track the process. Mm-hmm. And the same thing. I was like, oh, yeah, I'll be able to do that. And like, you know, I know that the bureaucracy of like, US immigration has never worked this fast in the past, but I'll probably be able to get them to just do it in 24 hours and I'll be home flying home tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I like walked away from the desk with like a slither of hope. But also like deep down knowing that like it's probably not going to work, but just not at the time when I should have been like preparing for like, okay, what's this going to look like? I just was refusing. This is denial. But also, I think this is probably a good time to explain to everybody that, like, I'm an alcoholic, and at that particular point in time, it was like not quite a year since I had you know, started my recovery and gotten sober, and I had really pinned on that expedition a kind of like ending of my like addict brain. You know, like I sort of thought, if I can like conquer this trip, I'm not going to have cravings anymore. It's just going to be easy for me not to drink. And in the lead up to that trip, because it was such purpose and all of that, it was. And immediately when we finished, hence the kind of like denial and, you know, real desperation, I guess, to like get home. It wasn't, you know, I was having that same kind of like free falling feeling, that you get sometimes, and I didn't know how to handle it, you know, and my thing was like, if I can just get home, you know, my sort of default is like, if I can get home and be like in the place that I know, and I can just like do my routine and do my thing, like I'll be fine. And so that was kind of a bit of context as to why I was so like in such denial, even though it seems obvious that I would have got stuck in Mexico. In my mind, I was like, I was like, I can't survive if I don't get home, so I'm not going to entertain that possibility. And then all of a sudden it was reality.
Yeah, it's interesting to, I mean, obviously we'll go a couple layers deeper, I think, into the psychology of all this, but I'm already starting to get a picture for, you know, mentally how you create these crutches in a way. Like, if I can just get home, I'll be okay. If I can just do this trip, that will be, for some reason, an imaginary door closing. When was your first drink post trip?
It was honestly like, so when I tried to leave, I had been in Mexico. Like when I tried to leave the first time, that story explained, I'd sort of been in Mexico for 24 hours. My international flight landed and my next flight wasn't until the next day. So when I got blocked, he said, you've got come back in 14 days and you can fly. But that 14 days doesn't count the first 24 hours. So the first 24 hours is like day zero. And then it's day one, and then it's 14 days at the end of the 14th day, not on the 14th day. So I immediately rebooked a flight. 14 days later from the second I landed in Mexico City, I actually tried to fly out again, and I got blocked again at the airport. But I drank the night before that. So I actually made it through this time around. I've had I'll get into that, but... So I actually made it until almost through to the end of the trip, where I actually held off, and it was a lot of going into gas stations, opening the liquor or the beer fridge, and like doing the look at like the blue Modelo box and like the cool air from the like refrigerator, and then closing it, and then like walking around. And like I was just by myself for most of that time, and I was like, no one would even notice, you know, which is like, you can do that at home anyway, but I was like, really no one would notice. Like I could do anything down here. And so I did a lot of that, and then I finally caved at the end.
That's interesting also that the mindset is other people noticing. Like it's not even necessarily about your own how it affects you. It's almost like projecting it on.
Yeah. Like it's like, yeah. I don't even like, and that's, I mean, I guess that's the thing. Like anything that stops you from drinking is good, particularly in like early stages of recovery. And so like, if you're shamed into not drinking essentially by the fear of like how you'll be judged by others. Sure. I mean, ultimately probably like there's definitely more healing that needs to be done, but for me, yeah, like you don't care. Like I don't care if I drink. You know, I want to do that. If I could just do that all the time and everyone just left me alone, Like, that'd be fine, you know? Like, in a world, if there was a world, this is addict me speaking, definitely don't feel like this now. But if there was a world where, like, I didn't have to work, right? And you could just live your normal life as you live now, like, I would, when I was drinking, I would have just chosen to eventually just, like, be a, you know, you just, like, I don't want to deal with anybody else. I just want to do this thing, and that's all I'll have to do. Like, and really, I honestly, like, one of the big motivators for me to get sober initially was that fact that I was like, there are things I want to achieve that I definitely am not going to be able to achieve if I'm, like, still drinking. In a work sense, like in an output sense. Anyway, so, like, yeah, that's where the, like, well, if I, you know, am seen drinking or, like, other people judge me by that, like, that's the sort of thing that was, for me, I was like, I just don't want to have to deal with that. I don't want to have to deal with someone knowing and then going through that whole process of, like, you know, explaining to them and them telling me that it's all right and that you can start again and then starting again and, like, not really caring, but doing it anyway, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, you sort of just...
Yeah. So, I listened to some of this most recent I Am Here podcast, and we'll get into what all of that is. But before you became sober the first time, how many people were aware of your drinking? Was it... Because you almost made it sound like you kept it pretty secret.
Well,
in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I kept my getting sober secret.
Okay.
And interesting. But there was no intervention. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, no one... Yep.
No one confronted you.
No, because, like, I was sort of in a position where I could, particularly during the pandemic, I could do whatever I wanted and not really take heat for it. And I was good at hiding.
Well, I mean, that was sort of an ongoing joke, I think, for a lot of people during the... I mean, everyone knows alcohol sales went through the roof.
Right.
And everyone's like, yeah, I became an alcoholic during the pandemic. Like,
yeah.
Socially, there was a certain expectation there in a way anyway.
Yeah. So, like, that, like, at that point, but I mean, I had been one for years before that. And yeah, some people had noticed and confronted me about it. I had sort of just been able to, like, slide past it. I mean, I got a divorce basically because I was drinking too much and a few other relationships had broken down. So, like, that happened, but I just had refused to, like, acknowledge it. But at this point in time, no one had, like, come and grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and been like, you need to sort your shit out. Because, you know, I was maintaining enough of a level of functionality, like, certainly not nearly the level of functionality that I can have as a sober, clear-headed person, but like, enough to just get by. No one like came and grabbed me by the scruff of the neck. But honestly, like, that I would not have responded well to that. Like, I had never responded to anyone doing that, you know, in the years prior who had been like, maybe you know, drink too much, you know, or like, maybe you have a problem, and I'd be like, you know, fuck you, basically.
When did you, at what point did you think you might have a problem? And how, like, obviously you checked yourself into rehab. Well, not obviously. For those that don't know, you checked yourself into rehab. And I imagine you learned a lot there, not just about yourself, but the trends.
Yeah.
Do you call it a disease? Do you call it...
Okay. Alcohol use disorder is, I think, the official name, but it's
so
a disease.
I'm sure you learned some the textbook type stuff.
Yeah.
At what point, maybe kind of two-pronged question here, at what point did you admit to yourself that you had a problem or that you were an alcoholic? And did you learn anything about what might, quote-unquote, define alcoholism?
That's a good question. So I think, like, the first time I ever, like, actually verbalized it was I want to say either when I like sort of called up. So it was during the pandemic, so you couldn't do any in-person, anything like that was all closed. So there was like, I did what was like an intensive outpatient program. So it's like 20 hours a week, essentially on Zoom calls, basically just like hanging out, like to stop you from drinking. And so it's like a lot of group therapy and then a lot of individual stuff. Anyway, but I think it was when I called to like see if they had an availability in this program was the first time I'd ever actually said and really acknowledged in my mind that I had a problem. So that was like 2020. But I had known and had tried several times to get sober over the previous, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. I had realized that my relationship with drinking is not a healthy one and it's not stable in any way. You know, there's no way you can coexist with this. But I had never...
Can you define what that looked like just on a daily basis?
Like as in the like...
What were your drinking habits look like?
So for me, I was... So my... Like I was someone who once they began drinking... really couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. Like even in any setting. And I still think like this now, but my thinking was sort of like, what's the point of just having one drink or like mm-hmm. two drinks? Like why even bother? You know, just drink water. Like if you drink to get drunk basically. Yeah. Which is crazy. And honestly, I still have that sentiment. You know, and I have no desire to drink at all.
Really? None at this point?
Not really, no. I mean, occasionally, like, there'll be like, I wouldn't necessarily call them triggers because triggers are, I still get triggers, but they're like, well, they're way different now and the way they manifest is different and my response is different. But I get like a whiff or something like,
yeah.
And it's always weird to me too because it'll be like Saturday at lunchtime. Like Saturday at like lunchtime seems to be the time, which is such, which feels weird to me because it's like, it's not like when I finish an annoying day at work or I'm stressed or anything. It's just like Saturday at like 11:30. And I'm like, damn, it would be nice to start drinking right now. Like I have that like second of a thing. So I don't know what that's about, but that's kind of the only time, if ever. I sort of fucking hate it, to be honest. I just have no desire. And so my like addiction has changed a little bit, I guess, but or my recovery has changed. But what it would like, so it would be, I wouldn't necessarily like, I wasn't someone who would wake up and drink in the morning. Like all that wasn't like the first thing I would do because I'm like, I have things I need to do. And I usually had like such an intense amount of self-loathing when I woke up because I'd drunk the night before that I would like abstain until the afternoon and then basically drink, you know, beer, or like seltzers. I could drink a shitload of those. So I could drink like 12 of those and then like maybe a bottle of wine or like maybe half a bottle of whiskey or more until like sometimes I would just go right through, particularly at the end I would just go through until like 6 the next day. I could just, and then I would do that like 4 or 5 times a week, which is crazy to think that that's what I was doing.
yeah
but I was. And so like, yeah, so it's sort of, and then again, towards the end, like I would never ever have a day where I didn't drink. But like throughout my drinking history, there was like a real variation. You know, I was like professional athlete for 3 years during, like, whilst in the middle of having, you know, a problem with alcohol, having or being an alcoholic. But at that time, it would be like, I would sort of have this internal battle where I would try not to, because I'm like, it's ruining my performance or it's hurting my performance. And so it's sort of like I had a book that I would write down each day that I didn't drink, and it would be like 4 days and 5 days, but then I would have these blowouts, you know, or you'd be on a race, you'd be at a race and you would finish the race, like a 5 day race or whatever. And I would remember finishing the race, and then I would wake up on the plane home and I'd be like, what? Like, wow. Like I'd be in the seat and like your teammate would be next to you and you're like, oh my God, like what happened? Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I still don't know. But yeah.
One thing that I was expecting to talk about is so in a way, like you had this peak experience with the ride across Iceland and then mm-hmm. this relapse. On a larger scale, you had a professional cycling career on the road. Mm-hmm. And then I expected to talk about retirement and how hard, you know, transition periods like that
yeah.
can be. That's something in talking to people on this podcast. I mean, that comes up every other episode, it seems like. But it sounds like the drinking issues started before you were done cycling.
They started like when I first retired. They started when I first retired. So gotcha. I retired. I did 3 years as a pro, 18 to 21. And then when I was like at the end of my contract, I was in Europe and I was supposed to, it was like assumed I would sign with Chipotle and go and race with Lockie. And I just like flew home and like, you know, blew it all off and was just like, I'm done racing.
Why?
I just was over it. I mean, if I'm honest, like I couldn't be the type of cyclist that I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And there was I had done it, I had been focused on being, you know, a professional at that point at 21 for like 10 years, right? Since I was like 11, 12, I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And it really had never wavered. And then in the last couple of years, I'd had a couple of bouts of illness and injury and stuff. And I, during that period, I was studying at college, and I'd sort of like seen what other people do, like as I was racing. And I was like, wait, other people just like do normal stuff? Like they don't have to, you know, bust their ass every single day. And then I was also just like not happy with like, I just like so much tied up in, I mean, you know this, I'm sure, but like it's a hard sport. Sport is hard. Everything's hard. But at that point in time, I'd like emotionally just had so many things go differently than I'd expected, and so many kind of like, I guess, learnings about life and about the world that I just couldn't reconcile while still being inside the sport. And so I just hated it, right? Every time I got on the bike, it was a reminder of like all of the things that I wasn't good at, or like mm-hmm. all of the things that I hadn't achieved, all of the things I was supposed to have achieved but hadn't, those sort of things, right? And so it got to that point where I was like, do you know what? I don't need this shit. Like at school, no one even knows me as a bike rider. Like no one. And so like I was like, okay, so I stopped and went and hung out with my friends at uni, and they were like going out and getting drunk on a Wednesday night and going out on the weekends, and I hadn't really been like, you know, I could probably count on the number of on one or two, you know, one hand, like the number of times that I'd been like proper drunk by the time I was 21, and or by, you know, by the time I was 20. And And I just loved it from the second I like started doing it. I was like, oh my God, like for the first time, like my brain is like quiet, you know, it's not like nagging me, like either to do more of something or like, why did you do something in this way? And so like, you know, from then it was like very instantly like such a relief. And you hear a lot of alcoholics, or at least I have, like say that same thing, you know, like they just knew it. It was like, you know, just this thing that just like absolutely calmed my mind. And so then I just kept doing it. And it wasn't straight away, like, you know, I didn't just go straight to like full ball drinking every day. That took over a number of years. to really like. And there was varying in that period of time, I had varying issues with it, right? Like, it's not just like a constant increase either. Like, sometimes I was better at being, you know, monitoring and being sort of like, at least in a consumption point of view, but certainly not from a mental health point of view. And then after a while, you just like, I think the thing that happens, at least for me, was like my like care of what other people thought had just eroded down,
yeah.
You know, to a point where like, if I black out and I behave like an absolute dipshit, whatever.
Interesting.
You know, whatever. Yeah. Like, but at first I was like mortified by that.
Yeah.
You know, so like it would sort of, over time.
Why did you make a comeback into racing at a high level?
Well, I think I had, well, not I think, I had unfinished business in a way. And it was interesting because there was a couple of things. Like, I was working in television in Australia as a director. I had just directed my first TV show, which is like a sketch comedy show. And I'd sort of, when I left cycling, I was like, I'm going to be a director and prove to everyone that I can like do something else. And so I really did. I just put my head down, worked my ass off and sort of worked my way up and got this job. And I was doing that and felt creatively like I couldn't just do, you know, I couldn't really direct in a sense, because you've got your bosses that are like, no, you can't do that, or do it this way. And you're like, why am I even here? Normal stuff. Right? Like normal stuff, which is, I fully get it now, but as a 24-year-old or whatever I was, I did not get it. I was like, I should be able to do whatever I want. Anyway, so I wasn't like feeling super creatively satisfied in that role. And my brother was racing and he wasn't sort of satisfied in the racing world. And we came together and did a ride. And in the process of like doing that ride across Australia, it was, I like got fit again and started getting going and started being like, oh, this is fun and this is interesting. And Lockie was like, you should race again. And then like so it was that. And then at the same time, a director had said to me, a much older director had said, like, if I can give you one piece of advice, it's to quit your job and go and do anything else but directing for 10 years and then come back, because you've got nothing to say.
Hmm.
You know, and if you just continue to do this, all you'll have perspective on is, or all you'll know what to talk about is like directing, you know, like all of your point of view will be from that. So he's like, you need to go and experience stuff. So it was like, Lockie had kind of been like, maybe you should do this. And I'd reconnected with Lockie, my brother, in such a strong way that I was like, oh, the opportunity to go and race alongside him would be amazing. And that was sort of the thing that we never got to do prior. At the, you know, because I had bounced before we got that opportunity. And so it was sort of like, yeah, why not? You know, like, why not go and do this and have this experience? And then the interesting thing was, you know, at first I was like approaching it really rationally and training, you know, really, I guess, like the way you're supposed to. But very quickly, like, you know, sort of 3, 4, 5 months into racing again, like the way that I used to think about racing like came back.
Mm.
You know, like to talk about neural pathways and how, you know, you can build them and strengthen them, but once they're there, they're there. Then they don't reduce, you just find other ways to cope. And so like as soon as I was doing the same thing, right, those same thoughts and those same thinking patterns and that, because they were so ingrained and so strengthened within my brain from such a young age, like they just started going again. And I would be just doing stuff and I'm like, what the hell? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Why am I, you know, why am I doing this, or why am I thinking like this, or why am I feeling like this?
So you're probably
in approach to racing.
You're referring to kind of like the, and this is, I think, probably something that a lot of people who have raced at a high level can relate to, when you're in that early, you know, junior U23 phase, and you have this almost like manic, at times illogical, idea of what you have to do to be your best. And it's like, the more sacrifice, the better. The more I carve out of my life to be singularly focused on one thing, the better athlete I'll be. And what you're saying is, you thought during this return you could have a more holistic, well-rounded, healthy experience with professional racing, but you kind of reverted back to that.
Yeah, yeah, gotcha. Very quickly. So that's exactly it. Yeah, yeah, nicely explained.
Was your how did your brother's perspective compare to yours? Was that some, as you were on the team together? Like, were you continuing? Because I assume on that long ride across Australia, y'all talked about this a lot and really rolled up the sleeves and like tried to unpack it. As you were back in it, was there any back and forth there? And because obviously his career spun off in a non-conventional direction now too.
Right.
Did y'all try to continue to like wrestle through that together, or how did that go?
Yeah, we did. And like, we did, particularly like, so I raced again for 3 years, from 2015 to 2017. And the first 2 years, Lockie was on the same team. And we had these like goals, right? And really like the culmination of that goal was to try and win like a Tour of Colorado or Tour of California. Or a Tour of Utah. And I think that by the second year, Tour of Colorado didn't exist. And the Tour of California, Lockie crashed out. And he won the Tour of Utah. And like that had kind of been since we very like on that ride across Australia, like that had sort of what we had talked about. And Colorado's our second home. You know, like my parents live there. We've been there, you know, nearly half our lives on and off. And so, you know, in terms of as close to a home race, like the Tour of Colorado is it, because it does. It goes on roads that we train on and that we've grown up on, riding on. So that was really like, you know, if we could achieve that, that would be crazy. So it was sort of like the first 2 years we're moving towards that. And then when Lockie won the Tour of Utah, it was like, we did it. And so, and you know, and it was all involved in like building out the team. And like, and even at that point, we'd also kind of started thinking essentially along the lines of like where Lockie's at now. We had started developing and trying to build out a team that's that. And so we're sort of like trying to make inroads there, and the, like, you know, nobody was seeing it, and would, that was sort of, you could, yeah. Anyway, so like Lockie was then like, well, I'm going to go back to the world tour because I want to sort of see if I can like compete at a high level again and maintain this sort of point of view. And so he went, and I wasn't good enough, and I thought, well, I'll do one more year, and if I can, in a year, if I can get good enough and get a contract, I'll go up to the world tour and I'll sort of continue. If not, I'll probably just go back to doing what I was doing and back to a normal life. And so when he left, then the sort of purpose kind of went out of it, to be honest. Like I realized that, oh, you know, the main thing that I was like getting out of being a professional athlete was the experience with my brother, and also the experience of like moving towards these bigger goals as a team, which I didn't have them personally. Like if I like deep down, and you need to have that deep down, as you know, like if you want to sacrifice everything and you want to like be really good at the thing, you have to want it really bad. And I just didn't. And so, yeah. So then that was it. But
did that affect y'all's relationship at all? Like when he made that decision to go world tour?
Not really. I don't think, like not, certainly not at first. And then once I'd finished racing and I was like trying to do my own thing, or was doing my own thing with thereabouts, like, and I'd sort of, when I left racing, I really wanted to essentially make films that like try and expose or examine like other ways of participating in sport that like have no, that have no grounding or foundation in performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of doing that and working with Rafa on developing what became the EF and that sort of program. And right when it kind of began to come to fruition, like I got kicked off of it, and it was with Lockie. Like it was with, you know, it was that films, the thing that became the film series with Lockie, and it had been like over a year of development working on it, and then to get booted. And I was like, this is kind of like the only thing I have left to say about the sport was to like this alternate program. And so then I got removed from it, and he kind of kept going. And also at that time I was like drinking a shitload, so I think we got distant then. We got more distant, just purely because like I was like, oh, and I also got deported from the US at the same time. So there was like a lot of things going on in my life that like, you know, I guess I felt sorry for myself is probably the right word. Mm-hmm. And so I like, you know, it was like we were distant then, but that was like post racing. Like it was good to see him go back. And then, I mean, what he's done with the Alterna program is so sick. And like, it has really done the thing that like, that I hoped it would, and that I'm sure like he hoped it would, and more. And that's all you can want, you know, to move the sport in a good direction. And then now we're much tighter again now.
Yeah. It's interesting how it sounds like you sort of had this vision of what sort of storytelling was missing potentially. And, you know, I think about how collectively, at least in North America, like cycling was still sort of in like that sunset of being so tied to the Lance Armstrong legacy and era. And everything was all about like this super heroic pinnacle of performance and like hype and winning and, you know, maybe a very traditional, narrow identity in a way. Like cycling very much had the content we saw, the storytelling we saw had a certain narrow carryover. I think, right. I don't know,
that's
sort of shooting from the hip. But what is it that, like, why did you think that there was room for this other sort of way to express cycling? What was motivating you? Why did you feel so much conviction about this style storytelling? Was it that experience you had, you know, with thereabouts and just like it proved itself out? Or was it just something you wanted to see and you saw it missing? Like how, cause you have been very, despite all of these hoops you've had to jump through, alcoholism, getting deported, like there's been a lot of shit going on, but you've stayed pretty focused on what makes you tick and this creative thing that you've brought to cycling that now, like, not to pump you up too much, but it has completely redefined the sport in a lot of ways. Like, let's be honest. Talk a little bit about that, I guess.
Yeah. So like to jump back when I left racing the very first time at like 21, traveling a lot racing, and the thing I became more interested in were these little snapshots of people's stories that I would get. You know, you'd be at the bus or whatever getting ready and like a random dude would walk past and he's like, what's going on here? Like, this is the route I walk to get my paper in the morning and I can't cross the street. Like, what am I supposed to do? And, you know, in my mind, I'm like, well, everybody knows the bike race is going on because like it's the center of the universe. And I started having those sort of interactions and becoming more fascinated with those. And those were having a lot more lasting impact on me than the race itself. And, you know, so I went and studied film and did all that. And then when Lockie and I did that ride across Australia, part of that outlet was, for me creatively, was to shoot portraits and write a little bit about like the characters we meet. And over the course of that trip, the number of characters we met and our connection with them and the experiences we had with them just purely because we were on our bikes was insane. You know, it was like we got such a deep connection with so many various people, and we learnt, well, I can only speak for myself, I learnt so much about, you know, my country and the people that live there and just different ways of thinking and different ways of life. And I was like, whoa, like I've learned in this 2-week trip across Australia, like 10 times the amount I've learned in all of the years of racing all around the world.
Yeah.
And I was like, and not only that, but like, this feels good. And like, it is good. Like my perspective is broadened and I've learned something, you know, like I am a better person as a result of this. And I couldn't say, and I still can't say that I'm a better person as a result of like racing in the professional peloton for as long as I did, you know, like, well, certainly not as a direct result of that. And so I had that experience and I was like, hang on a second, like what if, you know, because I knew up until that point I did that ride across Australia that I only ever thought of sport as like, you do it to get fit, to race, to compete. And if you do, if Like, why would you do it any other, like, why else would you do it? It's not fun to do. Like, training's not fun. The fun part comes when you win and you, like, turn around at everyone else and you're like, I'm better than you. That was my, like, that was my, like, egotistical approach to it. And I'd had this, like, you know, completely sort of, you know, perspective shift, complete perspective shift and my whole understanding. And so I started thinking about it and I was like, oh, what if we introduce this perspective? Like, what if we introduce this perspective to more people? And what if we do it, you know, like Trojan horse style through, you know, the professional peloton? And like, we sort of low key slide this in under everybody without them noticing. And all of a sudden they're like doing the thing that they thought they didn't like. And they're doing the German cyclo tourist thing. And they are, which is funny. So like, that was the beginning, you know, like thereabouts and outskirts and all of that. Like, I was interested in being very strict on like, on the looseness of the approach, but the approach always being, it's just to go and talk to people and like learn something and just be very open to that. And like, what if that was, and that's one extreme approach, you know, like, and particularly when I left sport, I was very much like, we don't need racing. We don't need competition. Competition is obsolete. Like, what we need is for people to use their chosen sport as a way to connect with one another, and that should be the sole purpose. And not even connect with just the people that they know within the community, like strangers, you know, like, and so that was sort of like my thinking, and so that was kind of the approach to it, and the epic distances and all of that were a way to, like, you know, kind of like hook the performance and those sort of like people that are into that, hook them in, and then they, before they realize it, they're like, oh, there is another way to do this. Anyway, so like, that was kind of very much, you know, my, and I still feel pretty strongly about, but my views have definitely like developed since then, and I competition is very important in my opinion, and I think there's better ways that we can do it. And I don't, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I think we can work on that. But anyway, but that was like, yeah, I guess the drive to kind of to do it and to explore it, you know, and I'm a filmmaker. So that was my way of exploring it. You know, if I was just an athlete, like, I would go and do these things like what Lockie was doing. But I'm not. Like, I can't just go and do the thing. Like, I don't understand it until I've, you know, written about it or made a film about it and like expressed it like in that way. Like, so that was, and that's kind of the medium that my way of getting it across is like, this is the thing that, this is my experience kind of like packaged and handed off to you. So yeah, that's kind of where all that came and where that conviction to like explore that side of sport came from, particularly immediately post-racing. I think like you might have experienced this, but it at like the top level, it's so kind of, and it's the same in any industry really, but like it's so selfish and self-absorbed and everyone's just like, ultimately you're just doing it for you, and like, you know, and terrible things were happening. I remember like athletes getting killed in races, like straight up dying, and you're like, for what? Like, no one even knows this race is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that risk was taken, like that kid wasn't aware of that risk that he was taking.
Yeah.
Sure, he did the move, but like, who groomed him for that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So anyway, I don't need to get into that side of it necessarily, but like, when that's the case and nobody around you is going, maybe we should just re-examine and reassess what we're doing. You know, even if at the end of that reassessment, we can say, do you know what? We're still on the right path. Sure, that's fine. But no one was willing to be like, hang on a second, let's just take a step back and look at what we're doing and work out if it's actually holding up to the values of sport and these sort of things. And No one was doing that. And I was like, I can't be a part of that. Like,
yeah. Well, it's, you know, crazy.
Just perpetuating.
It's crazy what gets normalized, you know, when something
fully
happens long enough and there's enough tradition involved and incentive and enough people doing it, it's wild what is just deemed a risk of the trade.
Yeah.
And when you pop your head up, you're like, wait a sec. I mean, it sounds dumb, but even at a completely different level, like Unbound last week, speaking of your brother, you know, he was in a crash. It was completely mind-bending how many pretty gnarly crashes there were in the first 30 miles. And I was just like, wait, this is gravel racing now? What happened to what we were doing 3 years ago? But anyway.
And I feel that because I think like gravel racing and, you know, like what the Legion guys are doing in Crit, like that's actually American cycling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, America hasn't had cycling until now.
Yeah.
Right. It's just true. Been European. It's always been like, it's always like to talk about the Lance Armstrong narrative. It's America loves to see themselves as the underdog, but at the same time, like the dominators of the world. Right. Like, and, yeah, and so it's like, that's so what true. His story was. Like his story was the underdog going to Europe to like, you know, like show them who's boss. And he did. And so that's like a really powerful narrative. But as soon as the American isn't winning, it's like, why do we care about this European sport?
Mm-hmm.
Totally fair enough, right? So I feel like gravel racing and that, like it is embodying all of these American cultural, like, you know, points of identity into the sport. So like I love that fact, and it's so malleable and all of that. But then to your point, there's always, you know, it grows, and with growth, like, comes all of those things, and particularly with technology. Just there's so much technology now that it's really easy. Not easy, but like you know what to do to get good. It's hard to get good, but like at least there's a pathway. And so everybody's really damn good.
Totally. And, absolutely.
And that's
absolutely
when like shit goes down. But yeah.
How are we doing on time? We're going longer than
I'm all right.
Cool. I want to get back to filmmaking a little bit, because I think it's interesting. You know, it sounds like you were sort of sent away by your boss to an extent, like you don't have anything to say. And then in a way you sort of like being banished helped you like stumble into this thing. And one thing I've really appreciated about your work and, obviously your work kind of spawning into a lot of the stuff that Rafa does with EF, is this ability to show rather than tell. Like the films have, I don't know if meandering is the right word, but like, they don't hit you over the head with the purpose. You know, there's not a bunch of like talking head stuff or narration or captioning and subtitles and all that sort of thing. And as someone that's taken a stab at making a couple of small films, I know how hard that is. Like it's this art, it's this subtlety that I really admire. Can you talk a little bit about maybe, you know, how you developed that? Is that just what feels right and it just happens that way? Or do you have, you know, I've heard you mention Werner Herzog in the past. Yeah. Like, are there certain people who stylistically have inspired you and that kind of guides things? How is that style developed for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So like when I first came to like film and love film, it was Errol Morris, like who's a documentary director, like The Thin Blue Line, Fog of War.
Yeah.
Bunch of like really
Thin
powerful.
Thin Blue Line is insane.
Right?
Everyone should watch that. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone should watch that. And what I liked about him was that he was able to he like used reenactment really interestingly to me in that film, The Fog of War. Essentially there were like five different accounts of how a scenario played out from different people. So they're not, you know, one of them's real and the other four are lies. And he kind of basically gamed them all out on screen and allowed the audience to kind of like find a truth. And then through that, he eventually got a confession to a murder. Anyway, I was like, oh, wow. Through this essentially like creating fiction, like through creating these events that never happened, we were able to work out the event that did happen. Mm. Anyway, so like for me, that point of view became, or that like the ability, the realization that you could do that through film was like, you know, really like mind, like a really, I was like, holy shit, this is fascinating. And then when I was a very like technical director initially. I was like obsessed with, or like very focused on like what lens length and then how we're going to move the camera and like all of that, like sort of like the language of film. I really loved it. And so that's what I was immersed in, or trying to as much as I could. And then was getting really frustrated with how you would spend all of this time doing work and then someone would walk in who was your boss, who had no idea of like the language of film and do something that you're just like, you can't, you're ruining it. You can't do that. And they would do it. And you're like, what? So I was like, no one even cares about this. Like, you literally hire me because this is the one thing that I know how to do, you know, and you're just ignoring it. Anyway, so in that experience too, I also like, you know, had learned and like a lot of really interesting and fascinating stuff would happen kind of like off camera or to the side of camera or like when the camera was facing at the ground or whatever.
Mm.
And it would never be used. And I was like, man, that's like the most interesting stuff. Anyway, so I sort of had all of those experiences. And then when we went and did the first Thereabouts film, it was essentially like an antidote to all of that. So it was like, what are all the rules that we have to stick by? Like Scott was the director of that first film, and he and I were like, we had worked together a lot, and we're like, these are the things we normally have to do. Like, fuck that. We're just going to do, we're going to embrace the other side of it. So it was sort of like, and then through that, I like developed, it like developed a style, which wasn't actually like my style, if I'm honest. It was just like a reaction and a freedom that I was like, oh, I want to explore this thing. And that became the style of Thereabouts and really like followed through. So like, that was how it came about initially, in just in terms of like camera approach to camera and even like how we sort of like let the story unfold was sort of like so that was like, that's kind of interesting to me because I think a lot of people are just like, oh, that's how you like to make films, and like honestly it's not necessarily. I prefer to be much more considered and much more like,
yeah, fair.
You know.
Well, it seems like you're getting, I mean, I don't know if you've gotten the opportunity to
do that. Yeah, we have more recently.
Okay, yeah. And like, I mean, the most obviously present example is this I Am Here film. But in a weird way, like, and maybe this is how all good films work, I don't know, or the most authentic ones, but something unexpected happened and like really swung the style.
Yeah,
in a way.
Fully.
Talk a little bit about, like, I guess we might as well talk about it, unless there was something else you wanted to say in regards to evolution of your style. But
the only thing I would like to say about evolution of style is like, it's definitely, now it's at a point where like Thereabouts were very much, those first films are like, let's go and see what happens. We're like, there's no point of view. Mm-hmm. We don't want to talk about the obvious thing. Like, we went and did a film about Route 66 and we refused to ask the question, what is Route 66? Like, it was supposed to just be like, this is like, we're traveling this route because, you know, we have these preconceptions of what it is and we're going to go along it and we're not going to make it about the route. We're just going to like see what comes up. And that's kind of like, you know, in essence, trying to give us the real, like what it really is, because we were being indirect about it. And I think now, you know, I've sort of done that and there is something interesting about that, but it also it can be really boring and go nowhere. So like, I'm definitely like leaning more back towards that considered and sort of sparse approach that I had before, where it's like, let's say as little as possible, you know, let's just like let the audience make their own meaning out of this and convey the experience like that this person's had, like essentially in as little, like we don't have to tell you, we just want to show it, like to your point, but like have their experience come through in like a very honest and minimal way, I guess. Like, so it's sort of, yeah, trying to like convey that feeling as opposed to like recount the experience.
Yeah. Does the name Joe Grant ring a bell? He spent some time living in Gold Hill, long distance runner.
No.
So I had him on a few episodes ago and he said something that just what you said just reminded me of it, which is this idea that especially within the industry and also kind of culturally, like take Tour Divide or Colorado Trail, something like that. Like these incredible routes, Route 66, these famous routes are used as like the backdrop to show a human doing a badass thing.
Mm.
And sometimes the place is almost like fades into the background and becomes so secondary.
Right.
And what you just mentioned in terms of the way that you approached that Route 66 film reminded me of that, where a lot of times, at least the film projects I've been a part of, like people are so fixated on identifying what the story is before you even go film the thing.
Yeah.
And you sort of did that backwards.
Yeah.
And the result is this very long, I mean, what is that? Like 80 minutes?
Yeah. Something like hour. That.
But yeah. Dude, the thing has 500,000 views.
And yeah. I mean, which is crazy for a film of that length.
Right. It has a very like, it's almost like a visual journal style in a way.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. Like it's so cool that, you know, y'all had the, or you, I guess, had the guts to do something that maybe wasn't being done and then all of a sudden realized that there was a big appetite for it.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, and that's like honestly, like I wanted to make that film and then had the support essentially of the team at Rafa to like do that, which like when it first came out, the people at Rafa were like the other people that obviously they'd kept it insulated. And in my mind, like Outskirts, like that film should be coming now after we've all been exposed to like the alt calendar and we're like, oh, okay, we've sort of slowly been introduced to this side of things. Now we're going to drop you into this, to this other, you know, side of cycling that's like got nothing to do with performance. And it's sort of like just these kids kind of doing whatever they want. And, you know, I feel like it should come now, but it came at the head. So like huge props to like the creative team at Rafa for like insulating that project from everyone in letting it happen and like letting it be the thing that it was. Because yeah, I mean, I feel like, again, like it was sort of like the antidote to what was out there. Like what's a fresh perspective that we can provide? What's a story that we can tell in a way that like hasn't been told? It's sort of, that was very much like, like the film was a response as opposed to like me wanting to go and specifically like tell a story in that way. It was like, how aren't these stories being told? And let's explore that, you know, as like, as a way of communicating.
Yep. 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 So all of that said, let's talk about I Am Here. Cause I mean, you've said it, but, and it's clearly gotta be obvious to the listener at this point, but this is an unbelievably full circle project for you. I mean, it basically has all of the elements or many of the elements of your past.
Yeah.
In a story that's, you know, you're in the midst of developing now. So I guess, I don't know. When did you announce the Kickstarter? Like last week, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So for those that are blissfully unaware, making movies is unbelievably expensive, even when they're not Hollywood films. Everyone knows Hollywood films cost millions and millions of dollars, but even more modest productions are very expensive. Can you talk a little bit about maybe what the film was going to be
And
then how it's evolved and how it's going to be different now? And you can do that literally in terms of storyline or just like scope and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So initially we went to Iceland and there was a film component for the expedition that we did. And myself and Isaac, who the two of us kind of head thereabouts on the creative front, he and I basically like wanted to make a film that blended like the subconscious and animation with the reality of the trip. And it was like these big, slow, like talking about a point of view, you know, using the landscape and you know, the expanse of white and this sort of ambiguous nature of land and sky and sea, like all kind of blending in.
Iceland's a good place to to sink into that.
Exactly. Like, and we were looking at this imagery and we're like, that's what we're feeling like. And yeah. So we wanted to make these 3 5-minute shorts that were each, you know, one from Chris, one from mine, one from Rebecca's perspective. And the story was essentially like, you know, telling the expedition from their point of view, and then like flashing back via animation to a point in their journey that like led them, that kind of like turned them onto the path of where they are now. And it was like a very, you know, sort of specific moment, and it would just sort of play out like this minute and a half long animation sequence that would be cut into their journey, that would sort of like essentially, how do we end up here? This, you know, and picking that like tiny kind of butterfly effect moment, I guess. So that was the original kind of concept and approach to it. And we went on the trip and had the trip, and you know, there was like it started to generate interest in the film and the trip, and people, you know, we sort of had a few people sniffing around like, could you make a 30-minute version? Could you make a 45-minute version of this film? And, you know, like I said, we'd set out to make essentially 15 minutes worth of film, and we were like, sure, let's explore it. Let's see what we can do. And this is like once we'd come back from the trip, once I'd come back from Mexico, no one knew what had happened to me in Mexico. You know, like I just sort of dropped off the face of the earth for a while and then was back, and no one knew. And we're going through the like how we would make this thing longer, and Chris messages me in the middle of the night one night, and he's just like, what if we, because he was like Chris of all people empathized with me being stuck in Mexico the most. Like it weirdly connected in a way that I knew what I was going through, but I sort of thought, well, no one else can like understand when I was freaking out about it. And he just kept messaging like, I can't believe you're still there. Like, you know, like he was really like, man, I couldn't imagine doing that. And you know, it's not actually that bad, but anyway, so he was really like on the same like page there. And he's like, why don't we try telling the story from your point of view in Mexico? You know, as a way that we could like frame it uniquely and like add a little bit of story depth to, you know, to build it out so it could hit the short category, the 40-minute sort of length. And I was like, well, would you let me write a script and we shoot the stuff, the Mexico side of things in a scripted narrative way.
So you knew immediately that you wanted to tell this story about being an alcoholic.
It's interesting because like when he framed it like that, I was like, oh, Chris is willing to go there. Not that I had the idea to do that in the first place, but like obviously he already had this experience. He didn't know. And he was just like just from a purely like not knowing I'd relapsed or anything like that. He just thought, oh, it would be interesting to see if we could figure out a way to tell it from that perspective, because it would just provide a cool like flashback or something like that to it. And then I was like, let me run with this. Let me just write something. And so I like went away, basically wrote like a treatment. And then I remember reading it to Rebecca, Chris and Isaac on the phone. And I was like, oh yeah. And then my character like relapses. And well, then I like relapsed, and you know, and then this battle between me trying to get sober, but also battling with the fact that I relapsed, and I'm flashing back to the journey, and like we get to the end of the call, and no one speaks, and then Rebecca's like, wait, you just brushed over this bit, you relapsed,
yeah,
and then I was like, yeah, and so like, and I was like, that's why this story is more juicy now, from you know, because that happened. And then I sort of, and I had explained to them on the very last day of the trip, when we finished the trip at the lighthouse, I told them that I was an alcoholic and that I had never thought I would be able to do this sort of a thing again. And I did it, and wow for me, you know, like, and it was really meaningful. So like they sort of had only just been introduced to that side of it as well. And anyway, and they were like, yeah, you know, Chris was like, yeah, let's do this. And so then, you know, then basically I wrote like a treatment, and then I wrote a few versions of a script, and the script is basically like based off of it's based off actual events, but it's an amalgamation of two experiences I've had in Mexico City, which both experiences involve relapse. So like, don't go to Mexico, Angus. one was like a very major, one was actually prior to me, and maybe this is why I was so nervous about going to Mexico, but I had traveled to Mexico on the way back from a shoot in the UK during the pandemic and got stuck there. And I had like a major relapse, like a 2 week full on send off. And so it's an amalgamation of like those two experiences. So there's like some circumstances like from the Iceland trip, and that storyline plays out. And then there are other experiences like filled in to kind of like, just kind of, because it really is, for me, it's like, it's an expression of what it's like, or what it's been like for me to get sober and to like deal with relapse. Because, you know, it's like, it's not like I was ever at the point where, you know, I was like kicked out on the street, or like if I didn't stop drinking, I was going to die. Like I was never at that point. And so there's like the stakes are less obvious, I guess, you know, when it's like that from a story point of view, or from a human point of view, like, oh, well, of course they got sober because like they were going to die. The motivation was there to do the thing. And so like, but there was none of that for me in my experience. So like the stakes are different. It's always kind of like, well, I mean, I guess I could drink again. Like my liver numbers are finally back to normal. Like, you know, physiologically wise, I'd be fine. Like, you know, you sort of like, no one told me to stop before. You just start justifying it. And so I wanted to sort of like, I guess, tell a story that spoke to that, to my experience with it, and how at the end of it, you're still not even close to like being fine. You know, you're still very much an addict. Like I'm still very much an alcoholic. And like, it's not like I achieved that thing in Iceland and it went away. And that was, you know, but it taught me a lot in a different way than I expected it to. Anyway, and so, yeah, so I kind of wanted to like go into that and recount my experience. And also as a way to like, to talk about relapse as being part of the process of getting sober, I guess. But also to, you know, that my experience of like having this goal and it not like being, the learnings that I had from that trip on Iceland weren't the thing that I expected. Because, you know, like climb to the top of a mountain and you'll see the world differently, or whatever that quote is. I think a lot of people attach like, oh, if I do this epic thing, like I'll be changed. And that's true. I wholeheartedly like believe in that. But like you can't expect the change to be obvious, or you can't expect the change to be something. Yeah. You know, it's going to be whatever it wants to be, it'll be. And that sometimes is really subtle, or it might not come out until months later and you don't realize the thing that you learned was something different. So I also wanted to like talk about that, because I think people think sometimes like, oh, there's a magic bullet for all of these things, and there isn't. But that doesn't mean that they're not even more important, or it's not even more important to do it. Because sometimes a magic bullet's like the easy, like if you get the magic bullet, like that's the easy way out.
Yeah,
in a way,
absolutely.
You know,
yeah. I mean, it's funny because that's kind of a sort of a parallel, like the climb to the top of a mountain refrain is similar almost to like the what we were talking about a minute ago in regards to the movie making process. Yeah. Or the storytelling process. Like there's something to be said for not going in with the story predetermined.
Yeah.
One thing that's interesting is, you know, I've heard you say it a couple of times today and elsewhere, obviously, is this continued refrain of I am an alcoholic. Like clearly that's an active thing you're doing, like drawing that line in the sand. And while you are sober, saying I am an alcoholic in a way sort of is like planting your flag, like I still don't have a healthy relationship with alcohol, and thus I am still an alcoholic. Like you don't have to actively be drinking to still be an alcoholic. And that's something I've never thought of.
No, absolutely. And I never thought of it too. And I think one of the hardest things getting sober was the permanence. You know, like I do remember going in like the first, the first group, and they're just like, you're never going to be able to drink again. It was like one of the first things my counselor said to me. And I was just like, what? You know, like, yeah, but I'm different. And everyone says that. And I mean, like, I knew it by that point. I knew that that was probably the case. But like, just the thinking about it, you can't. You just, I just was like, I thought about it for 1 second and it was like, it gave me the like runaway feeling. And so I was like, all right, you know, this is cliche, but it works, like one day at a time. And I, you know, I still go to AA. I still like, I still see like a, an addiction therapist and like, I still have to work on it. Like I still have triggers, like shit comes up out of nowhere and I behave like a crazy person. And I'm like, where did that come from? So like, I'm still dealing with that and my brain is still changing and repairing and whatever. And, but I never want to forget what I was. Cause it's, I can't really remember like what beer tastes like, or like, I can't really remember like what the taste of like vodka is. If I think about it, I remember the effects and all of that and like how I feel towards it. Like I still know that it's fun when I'm drunk. Like I like that feeling, you know, and that will maybe never change. I don't want to drink, but anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that like, I never want to forget that, that I had that, that that was an issue. And I don't want to ignore the fact that, you know, my brain, those neurological pathways that are stimulated by alcohol, they never get weaker. They're there. Mm-hmm. And so like, if I fire those babies up again, they're going to fucking like that dopamine and all of that's going to get that release. And I'm going to be back in it. And I've seen a lot of, and met a lot of people that have had that happen, 12 years sober, 20 years sober, and they relapse and they go back and they they blow their lives up within a few months. And so like, that's terrifying. And so because of that, like part of ongoing treatment and all of these things, you know, like I said, I don't have the craving to drink almost ever, but I know that I need to keep like reminding myself and working at it, because you never know where it's going to come from. And I just don't want to, I just don't want to forget. And I just, cause I just don't want to ever drink again, basically. Yeah. Like I know that if that happens, like that would just be such a bad thing. And it would be so hard to just do this all again. I don't need that. So it's like a way of reminding myself that, and it's fine. I'm fine with it. Like I'm fine that I'm an alcoholic now. I was really embarrassed about it before, but like whatever. I'm very lucky that I have come out of it. I'm very proud of myself for getting sober and for taking those steps. And I'm not ashamed of it. I'm fucking ashamed of the things that I did for sure. And like the person I was, but I'm not ashamed of like me now. which is all of those things rolled into it, you know?
You're not ashamed of the tag.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and the person that I am now, I'm happy with it. I'm proud of. So, and like that, that person wouldn't be the person they are without doing all of those really shameful, shitty things. So, you know.
I was about to say on a more personal note, but I feel like personal notes is all we've been talking about. But I am curious, you know, filmmaking has been, like you've always woven kind of the personal with the professional to an extent, but obviously this is by far the most personal or intimate project to this point, I would assume. And I'll never forget when I was riding with Chris in Iceland and he first mentioned to me this project. We had one of those wonderful Icelandic days where you have a 45 mile an hour tailwind just for 3 hours straight. And it was just absolute heroic vibes. And he started, you know, and he didn't tell me that much, but he told me enough to where I really got chills about the potential. And, you know, had, I guess, a similar reaction to the folks on that Zoom call you mentioned when there was just kind of silence on the other end. It just hit me like a ton of bricks. Like I could just tell, even though it was just a secondhand conversation, the potential of this project. So I can't imagine what it must feel like to be in your shoes. On a personal note, what's the process been like? Like, are you, has it just completely consumed you, or are you able to create a bit of separation to where it still feels career oriented to an extent? What has that been like?
I mean, yeah, like it's interesting. Like I love making films and that's what I want to do. And you know, like the fact that this is my story, like, you know, ideally, you know, in an ideal world, like I wouldn't make films about myself, to be honest. Like I would be able to make them about other people and tell other stories. But this was an opportunity in a sense of a really unique story and the way that we could combine these two things. And I really wanted to get back to scripted stuff, you know, move and sort of get back into the world of scripted narrative filmmaking. So like there's that element of it and the enjoyment of like being very technical and the excitement about like, oh, you know, we get to like create this world or recreate this world in a filmic sense is really exciting and daunting. So that's like that's one side of it. And the process of writing, which I wrote first versions, and then we had a screenwriter, Ben York Jones, come in and kind of like transform it again. So that side of it's really good. You know, doing the breakdowns and creating an approach and all of that has been really enjoyable and daunting, but in a good way, in a way that feels like you're stepping into uncharted waters and it's stretching you. But then from a personal point of view, like I honestly like I kind of lost my mind. I had to I've had to step back from it because we got really close to production in January. We were going to shoot the Mexico City stuff in January, which we haven't shot, and we spent 2 weeks down there in November, basically scouting locations and sort of shooting some like animatronics and just bits and pieces to kind of like create a sizzle for the film, but just get a feel and work with the production company and DP and that sort of stuff down in Mexico City. And the process of then like doing that, writing the script, and then sort of like trying to extract like the darkness, you know, in the worst moments, like I found it really difficult. And I don't know if you'll notice, but like I talk about the character in Mexico as a character. It's me.
Mm.
It's my story. But I have to have that separation. And it's funny pitching this film or talking to people about the film, like, why do you keep saying character? Like, it's you. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. Like, I have to, for me personally, I have to differentiate the two because, like, it was kind of making me go crazy, like, reliving that shit. And then, like, yeah. But in a way where it's like, like, what lens length should we shoot this at? And, like, what should the camera move be? What should the camera move be here? And you're like, what's going to be like the most heavy? Like, should we do, you know, when he's like smashing his head up against the mirror, like, are we going to be pushing in? Or like, should we just stay wide and like let the scene play without any coverage? You know, like, what's the, like, how are we going to do this? You know, where, and it was this weird, like, process of doing that where I kind of, I don't know why. I think I just got, maybe every filmmaker goes through this when they're like deep in the making of a film and there's a lot of pressure to make it good or to try and think creatively. But I was just like, I was so sick of just reliving the shitty parts of me that when we didn't go for production in January, I fully like have had to like step right back from it. And I'm basically like, I've sort of like with Isaac, who's the EP like producer and my partner, I'm just like, look, like when we have the run of this film and we've got like, you know, 2 months or 6 weeks until production, like that's when I'll make my run then. And I'll go deep then because I don't know if I like have the energy to be able to sustain it because I have to perform in this too, which is like another very new and strange concept for me. Like I've worked with actors before, but I've never like been, well, I've done a few bits and pieces like for friends, films and shows and whatever, but I've never thought of myself as an actor.
Yeah.
And so there's that element as well, which is new. But I mean, I'm just being myself. But anyway, so there's a few things that are like involved in this, like on the personal side that make it like kind of hard to just repeat.
Of course.
Because it's like, you know, you want it, you know, like let's be real. Like we want to see the character like do shitty things and we want to see him like go through hell and we want it to like be dark because we want to see that change and we want to see that character grow or learn something or not. You know, but like that's me. And then thinking about that, particularly since we started the Kickstarter, thinking like everybody knows that now is an interesting which I hadn't really thought of before. And that's sort of an interesting concept now, but I mean, whatever.
Yeah. At what point? Yeah, boy, I mean, that's a lot to wrestle with. And to go, like, it's been interesting also to kind of follow the timeline of how you've gone public with all of this stuff. I mean, really public with some of the most intimate parts of your life. And now there's like this next phase where you're trying to tell the story in this comprehensive way and are yet having to go public with it in a way again. When was the decision made to go the Kickstarter route? And for those that don't know, there's we'll post a link in the show notes so folks can click on it. But you're looking to raise $180K,
yeah,
which is a lot of money. But as far as filmmaking goes, it's not a lot of money.
Oh my God, no! It's like shoestring.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about kind of the decision to go the Kickstarter route and what's left to do?
Yeah, so the decision, like Chris Burkhardt had a lot of success with Kickstarter in the past with his film Under an Arctic Sky, and Kickstarter were actually kind of hitting us up like, you know, Chris, what's next? Like, you've got this film, let's do Kickstarter. And so we were like, initially we made the decision last year to go with Kickstarter, because we were like, all right, this is the quickest way to get it done, in a sense of like raise the funds and we can just go and do it. And then it sort of like got traction, like a bunch of producers and a few production companies like all of a sudden got quite interested in it. And part of the process of making this film was for Isaac and I were like, well, we, you know, this is what we want to do more of, is this scripted stuff, and we want to participate in the system. Like, I've had this thing since I started filmmaking where I'm like, I never enter a film in a film festival. I never charge or anything like that. Like, it's always just been like, I just want this work to go straight to the people. Cause like with film festivals, it holds it up for a year or whatever. And it goes, you know, and there's all sorts of stuff and there's all sorts of like promo stuff. And I'm like, I just want the thing to go out there and people can see it and whatever. So everything that I've done has been as much tied to that as it possibly can be, just getting it out. And we've never entered anything in competition or whatever, unless like competitions have asked for it. So anyway, so like all of that we had ignored, and then you realize that, okay, there's part of participating in that process and going to these festivals and doing that that helps you get the next thing made. And so, you know, we were like, okay, let's do a festival run. Let's like see if we can't co-produce this with, you know, a production company that that sort of exists more in the film world rather than the outdoor world. And so we sort of explored a few avenues there and we got close with a few people, but it was one of those things where the challenge of like explaining the concept and then accommodating the changes that a lot of these people wanted to make, like there's that, and this is fair enough, but like an indie film, for an indie film to hit, you know, you need to have a famous person in it, like which we didn't have, or you need a famous person directing it. And it's like, well, I'm both of those people and I'm not famous. Like, I really want to direct this because it's my story. And honestly, like, that's what I want to, you know, that's what I am, as a director. And so like, I felt strongly about that. And then there's no, the Mexico City stuff is really sparse character wise. So there's no room for like, to find another, right, you know, sort of famous person to really play any role of note. So anyway, so like we sort of looked at that and we're like, I don't know if we can necessarily do that. And also then it becomes, you're starting to change the film to fit into. So all of this is to say that we've got to the point where we're like, look, let's just do the Kickstarter like we said we're going to do so that we can fund the post-production of the film and let's make the film, you know. And by virtue of doing the Kickstarter, you know, people that support it are getting a copy of the film and all of that. So like, we're giving them something, giving our supporters something in return. We're maintaining creative control and it allows us to finish this film at a pace that we want to. You know, we don't want this story to get old necessarily. We want to make it now. We don't want to have to continue to sort of entertain these conversations and yada, 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 and another year's gone by. Like, I feel like we just started conversations with some of these production companies and it's been 6 or 7 months have gone by and it hasn't really progressed to a point where we're like, you know. So anyway, so all of that is to say that, like, we're fortunate enough that we have Chris's following and supporters that will get behind something like this. And so that's why we chose to go the Kickstarter out.
Yep. And you've continued to kind of build some, I don't know what to call it, like almost like auxiliary storytelling around the process. So you have a couple of podcasts up
on
thereabouts.co. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing there? I listened to some of the second episode and it's quite interesting. What's the plan moving forward there?
Well, like, yeah, from my point of view, like, just to link to the Kickstarter, like, the idea of promoing, like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to market stuff. But I know how to, like, tell stories or whatever. And so that's like how we, you know, there's a series of pods that kind of go behind the scenes of I Am Here and the making of the film. So that's that. And then with Thereabouts, like, you know, we wanted to, like, we have some podcasts that we do and the goal kind of our podcasting is, right, is to make a show that sounds the way a film looks.
Mm.
You know, and so we have a show called Outspoken, which is, you know, less of a conversation and more of like telling a specific part of a person's story, I guess. But we have, you know, we try and create, like I said, make a show that sounds the way a film looks. And that's sort of, yeah, that's kind of just like a passion project, to be honest. And it's something that we just like to do. And, you know, as you know, films take a really long time to make, even short ones. You know, we've been working on a 20-minute film for like 8 months, a little bit less, 7 months now. You know, like, it's 20 minutes long. Like, it's, so these things take forever, whereas like you can make a 40-minute podcast in a few weeks. So it sort of satisfies the storytelling itch for us there. And I mean, you know, one day it would be nice if that could sustain itself and we would have the ability to kind of keep like pushing that envelope of like how we tell those stories and kind of get as creative as we possibly can. Because right now, I mean, that's going back to maintaining control, like you get to do whatever you want with it and you get to make it whatever format. And that's like really satisfying. But at the same time, you know, eventually you got to keep the lights on somehow. So we're trying to like navigate that kind of ridge line now.
Yeah. And you've also got the Ramble.
And then Ramble.
Pod.
Ramble's just shit talking between my brother and I.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I feel like Lockie's a funny dude. And you know, I enjoy talking to him.
You're probably one of the only people that, you know, he'll... I don't know Lockie very well either, but you can certainly get him to open up in a way that very few other people could.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. And vice versa. Like, it's always fun talking to your brother. And, you know, to be honest, like, initially, we're just like, it's a good way to catch up. Because it's like, all right, we have this, like, date in the book that which is kind of fucked up, but also it's nice.
It's the modern way.
It is.
And all of that's at thereabouts.co, is that right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So just head there and there's, you know, a bunch of stuff there.
Cool, man. Well, swimming our way back to the surface, it's probably about time to move on to different things for the day. But
yeah,
I really appreciate you giving us so much time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you being interested in, having me on. It's been really fun.
Yeah, of course. And you said you're in LA now. How long have you been in LA? Where in LA are you?
Since the beginning of the year. I live in Echo Park, like up against Elysian. So, yeah, I lived here once before. And, you know, you got to be where the industry is.
Absolutely.
Like, and this is, you know, like as I try and push more into the traditional sort of film and TV world, I just figured I need to be here. And I enjoy it. I mean, it's different from the mountains, but... For now, this is what I got to do, so it's fine.
Yeah, how's your relationship with the bike at this point?
It's funny you should say that. Like, I honestly don't ride a lot. I run, mostly run. But in recent weeks, last couple of months, like I was down in Colombia with my brother, Lockie, and it just looked fun. And it's the first time I've kind of like in a long time where I've thought about just getting out on the bike for fun and it being fun. Like the idea of, you know, like, oh yeah, like cruising down the road would be a fun feeling. You know, so anyway, so like I'm definitely like in a good place in terms of mentally, like how I feel about the bike and my desire to ride it. But then like I finding the time.
Yeah.
Well, not finding the time. There's always time. Dedicating the time. I haven't done that in a way that I want to. And I was just thinking about this morning before you got on. I was like, I need new tires. So anyway, I think I'm like, yeah, I want to.
Cool, man.
That's good.
Good to hear. All right. Well, congratulations on all the cool stuff you have going on. And
cheers,
I really, really look forward to seeing everything come to fruition. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, man. Yeah, will do. Appreciate it. You too. Yep.
Thank you again, everyone, for listening today. Like I said at the top of the show, for those interested in supporting I Am Here and the Kickstarter campaign to bring this incredible film to the finish line so that we can all see it, go to the show notes and find that link, direct link to the Kickstarter. There's lots of different tiers there that you can contribute to. I know that the listeners of the Adventure Stash are engaged. You've proven that over the years. I really appreciate it. And I'm asking you right now to go support that Kickstarter. This is one of, you know, there's a lot of media out there these days, obviously, a lot of films, a lot of content, but this is one I really feel strongly deserves coming to fruition. So Gus, Chris, Rebecca, and myself, I'm sure would all appreciate it if you would join the effort. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show. A big thank you to Hammerhead for supporting this episode. If you want to get more out of your rides, I highly recommend the Karoo 2. This is the most powerful head unit I've ever used. It also has shockingly good battery life for how much it'll do. If you throw it on battery save mode, it can easily go 12, 14, 15 hours, depending on what you're doing. At the top of the show, I mentioned how I used it on battery save mode for Unbound and finished 9.5 hours later while running a GPS track with 51% battery. I remember when I did my own ride across Iceland last year, I had it on battery save mode also and similarly was following a GPS track and didn't have to plug it in to an auxiliary battery until hour 15. And even then, I had over 30% battery left. So in hindsight, I think I could have made it the entire 20-hour ride across Iceland. Pretty incredible. The Hammerhead Karoo 2 has raised the bar for cycling computers, and you can get advanced GPS navigation, intuitive software right on your handlebars in a way that you never thought was possible. And for a limited time, you listeners can get a free custom color kit and an exclusive premium water bottle with the purchase of a Hammerhead Karoo 2. All you have to do is visit hammerhead.io right now and use promo code STASH, that's all caps, STACHE, to get yours today. That's a free custom color kit and premium water bottle with the purchase of a Karoo 2. Go to hammerhead.io, add all three items to your cart. That's the custom color kit and the premium water bottle along with the Karoo 2. And use promo code STASH, all caps, STACHE. Thank you all so very much for listening, and we will catch you next week.